Farther west. Travel my way, take the highway, that's the best. Get your kicks on Route 66. Leap wines from Chicago to...
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Lori, covering Kingston's status as a Nature Canada bird-friendly city.
Hello, I'm Christina Lori, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
The City of Kingston has officially received an entry-level bird-friendly city certification from Nature Canada. To obtain a bird-friendly city status, a municipality must earn points across three categories: threat reduction, habitat protection, restoration and climate resilience, and community reach and education. Certification is awarded on one of three levels: entry, intermediate, or high. The city established a bird team about a year ago to work towards making Kingston more bird safe. Notably, the city held a public poll to name an official bird this past fall, a lively race which ended in a tie between the cardinal and the crow. According to the city, Kingston's application received strong marks, bordering on the intermediate level. Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the city, sat down with CFRC to share more about the city's bird-friendly status. I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about the city's bird team and the work that's gone into this to get us here.
Yeah, so the city started working on their bird-friendly certification about a year ago. We have a bird-friendly team, which is a very, we've got some very active people on the team. The team consists of some community groups like Little Forests, Master Gardeners, Kingston Field Naturalists, Sustainable Kingston. It includes people from Queens and St. Lawrence. It includes some representation from some different Indigenous groups. So it's a very active team. And we worked together to pull together an application. And the application really looked at a number of different things. It looked at threat reduction. It looked at how to conserve and restore and create bird habitats. And it looked at how do we engage the public. So the city worked on that, but the team also worked together. So the team came together. They did three World Migratory Bird Days this year. One of the groups had got a grant to run one of those Migratory World Bird Days where they did a hedge seminar. So they taught people how to plant hedges, which were great for birds populations as well. So lots of stuff has gone into it. Our application went in. We were certified at the entry level, but we were like 1 point short of intermediate level. So our bird team is working really hard right now to make sure we can gain that point and move us up to an intermediate level for next year.
Awesome. And you just mentioned there, bird team has no plans of stopping. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what's in the works and maybe what we're going to see in 2026.
Yeah. So 2026, we actually have a meeting coming up in February to talk about what our goals are going to be for that for next year. I think what you will probably see is some stuff on light pollution that we'll be working on, some stuff on bird window collisions that we'll be working on. And possibly some stuff in Roman cats. There's a lot that's also happening with the city. So right now the city is working on their official plan. We're working on our natural heritage study. We're working our forestry management strategy. Out of that will also come our tree bylaw. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's happening at the city that will go into that conserve, restore, create bird habitat sections of the report. And hopefully we'll see some changes in that in the next year as well.
Awesome. And what can residents do to contribute and keep up with all these developments?
We have a new bird-friendly page on the city's website, which talks about all these different areas and gives residents some ideas of things that they could do To help support birds as well. So we encourage people to take a look at that. Other things they can do is just, you know, making sure they're creating habitat for trees, not letting cats roam. If they're leaving out food, understanding where that best is to go and what quality of food people should be putting out. Lots of things they can do, lots of ideas on our website. Lots of work also with Little Forests, Master Gardeners, Kingston Field Naturalists. They're always working on things to do with birds, plants. So anyone who's looking to be involved, that's an excellent avenue as well to join in with the community and work on some of these activities with us.
Once again, that was Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the City of Kingston. As Santucci said, the city and their bird team look forward to setting new goals and advancing Kingston's status as a bird-friendly city next year. Learn more about the city's bird-friendly city activities and how to make your home a bird-friendly space at cityofkingston.ca/bird-friendly. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Over to Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a near 10% tax rate hike proposed in the 2026 Gananoque budget.
Thank you, Jesse. A draft 2026 budget that would see Gananoque residents paid nearly 10% more in property taxes is forcing council and the community into an increasingly unavoidable conversation about aging infrastructure, rising provincial costs, and what level of service the town can realistically afford. Mayor John Beddoes says the proposed 9.7% increase to the municipal property tax levy, coupled with an estimated 3.8% increase to water and wastewater rates, reflects the cumulative impact of long-deferred maintenance, provincially mandated spending, and limited room to maneuver without cutting services. One of the most significant year-over-year increases comes from policing, with the Gananoque Police Service budget projected to rise 5.13% over 2025. Beddoes has attributed the increase largely to new provincial service levels and training requirements, rather than discretionary local spending, adding council will examine alternative policing delivery models in 2026 to reduce per capita costs. Despite a series of targeted cuts and reallocations, collectively reducing pressure on the tax levy by approximately $416,000 or by 1%, the mayor said the underlying drivers of the budget remain largely unchanged. Council, however, has shown little appetite for service reductions to date. The 2026 capital budget includes $190,000 to replace a sidewalk snowblower, an expense that could be avoided through reduced service standards, but one council has so far chosen to maintain. Looking beyond 2026, Beddoes said council must begin grappling now with long-term capital liabilities, particularly the eventual replacement of the Lou Jeffries Gananoque and the Township of Leeds and Thousand Islands Recreation Center, which is expected to reach the end of its life in approximately 19 to 20 years. Beddoes noted that there is currently no reserve set aside for the arena's replacement. Another option raised by the mayor involves deaccessioning or selling municipal assets that do not support core service delivery, including leased properties, parking lots, or surplus lands. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with the story from the LJR reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, that provides an update on the ongoing OHIP litigation involving Dr. Elaine Ma.
Thank you, Dinah. As Ontario's Health Insurance Authority moves to appeal a court ruling that acknowledged the exceptional pressures of the COVID-19 pandemic, Kingston physician Dr. Elaine Ma says the motion to request an appeal sends a troubling message to doctors who stepped up during a public health crisis. On Tuesday, December 16, 2025, Ontario's Divisional Court made a decision that partially favored the Kingston physician in a dispute over more than $600,000 in COVID-19 vaccination clinic billings. 2 weeks later, OHIP filed a motion seeking leave to appeal the Divisional Court's decision. Ma organized 48 mass vaccination clinics in Kingston during the pandemic and was later ordered by OHIP to repay $600,962 for alleged billing noncompliance, a decision upheld by the Health Services Appeal and Review Board, HSARB. On judicial review, however, the Divisional Court ruled it was unreasonable to conclude that the COVID-19 pandemic did not constitute an extenuating circumstance and sent the matter back to HSARB to reconsider how much, if anything, Ma must repay. In the motion filed with the Ontario Court of Appeal on Tuesday, December 30th, OHIP argued the court misinterpreted Section 17.5 of the Health Insurance Act, which allows payment in, quote, extenuating circumstances, and raised issues of broad public importance for the administration of the provincial health insurance system. OHIP maintains that the court's interpretation improperly expands both the scope of Section 17.5 and the board's authority, and warns that it could complicate future physician billing disputes. Ma emphasized that, for her, the case has always been about accountability and transparency. At a time when Ontario is facing a growing physician shortage and strained public trust in the healthcare system, Ma said the message sent by continued litigation is concerning. Quote, physicians need to know that acting in good faith in service of their communities during a crisis will not be later met with years of punishment.
And thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Back to the LJR reporter for CFRC, Christina Laurie, covering a story about the installation of the first peace pole at Breakwater Park.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, local journalism initiative reporter for CFRC 11.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Kingstonians can expect a new monument in Breakwater Park in 2026, with Council unanimously supporting a request from Kingston's Rotary Clubs for the city's first peace pole. Moved by Councillor Brandon Tozzo, the motion highlights the work of Kingston's four Rotary Clubs, the Rotary Club of Kingston, Cataraqua Kingston Rotary Club, Kingston Waterfront Rotary Club, and Kingston Frontenac Rotary Club. Rotary has more than 100 years of history in the city, supporting local organizations through direct service, fundraising, and community partnerships. Rotary is a global network of more than 46,000 clubs worldwide, servicing their communities. Rotary clubs across the globe have installed more than 250,000 peace poles, monuments bearing the message, "May peace prevail on earth." John Farrow with the Cataraqua Kingston Rotary Club spoke before council, explaining what a peace pole entails.
And peace poles have been around for decades, but the goal of Rotary International is the planting of peace poles in communities all around the world. A peace pole is a tangible symbol of Rotary's commitment to peace building. Well, it's four-sided and divided into top and bottom halves, making eight panels. One panel is reserved for the sponsoring club or clubs, and this one would say the Rotary Clubs of Kingston. The other panels display the message, "May peace prevail on earth," in seven languages. The ones selected for this peace pole are English, French, obviously, Mohawk, Ojibwe, Mandarin, Portuguese, and Arabic. The Aboriginal languages are the two most common spoken in the area, according to the Indigenous Language Nest, and Mandarin, Portuguese, and Arabic are the most common non-English or French languages spoken in the area, according to City of Kingston statistics. You'll see a little gold plaque at the waist of the peace pole. That is the message in Braille as well for vision impaired.
Councillor Brandon Tozzo brought the motion forward, framing it as both a recognition of Rotary Club's work and a forward-looking partnership.
I'm bringing forward a motion that highlights something very special in our community and the people who choose to serve it in the spirit of peace, collaboration, service to that embodied by the Kingston's Rotary Clubs. Here in Kingston, we're fortunate enough not to have one, but four Rotary Clubs. The Rotary Club of Kingston, the Cataraqua Kingston Rotary Club, the Kingston Waterfront Club, and the Kingston Frontenac Club. Collectively, their members give thousands of hours each year to projects to strengthen our cities, support families, help youth, and advance sustainable and community well-being. I think their track record speaks for itself. One of Rotary's longstanding initiatives is the installation of peace poles. These are simple but powerful monuments inscribed with the simple message, "May peace prevail." More than 250,000 peace poles have been installed worldwide in parks, in schools, in city centers, and in places where communities gather. They stand as reminders that peace is not an abstract idea. It's something we build together, one action, one relationship, and one moment at a time. Kingston's Rotary Clubs have asked to partner with the city to install the first peace pole here in Kingston. They have proposed Breakwater Park, working in collaboration with staff as a motion, a space where residents, students, and visitors come together, where we celebrate our waterfront, and where a permanent symbol of peace would be both visible and meaningful.
With unanimous support from council, city staff will now work in partnership with Kingston's Rotary Clubs to identify a suitable location within Breakwater Park, with a goal of installing the peace pole no later than the second quarter of 2026.
This monster request will have a positive impact. It will strengthen our partnership with organizations that consistently invest in our community. It adds small but significant symbol of unity in a well-loved public space and underscores Kingston's commitment to being a city that chooses peace in how we live, how we serve, and how we engage with each other.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about the possible completion of the Wesleyville Church Restoration Project in 2026.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. A big year is in store for the Friends of Wesleyville Village, as interior restoration of their historic church will take place. A 2001 fire destroyed much of the interior. Now a new roof will be installed, followed by appropriate renovations to secure an occupancy permit. Wendy Schroeder with the Friends of Wesleyville Village speaks to the massive projects ahead.
2025 is a really exciting year for us. I think the big word here is momentum. So certainly we did see the door and the windows all replaced in the church this year, and that's, you know, an incredible milestone for us, because after the fire in 2021, we had a huge outpouring of community support, and so we've been working behind the scenes since then, but in 2025 we could finally see the fruits of those efforts back in place. So all of the windows have now been restored and replaced. The door and the window above has also been replaced. So that really is coming close to completing the exterior of the church. The next thing that we really had to take a look at in 2025 was the condition of the roof. The roof has been there for quite some time. I don't have the exact year, but I don't think it owes us anything at this point. And so we applied for funding through the ACO, and we were approved. So that means that we'll be able to move ahead with the replacement of the roof. So given that it's the middle of winter, we haven't replaced it yet. However, the contract is in place, and I think it'll start moving along soon. So that's another major milestone for us. And one of the reasons that's a major milestone is that we need to make sure that the roof is watertight before we start any of the major interior renovations. And that's a really big project, so we obviously want to protect what we're working on inside as well.
Now, just speaking of the roof itself, was that damaged in the fire in any way, in terms of like smoke damage or flames? Was that damaged?
No, the roof was not damaged in the fire. A lot of the damage, most of the damage, was interior. The structure of the building is still sound, and the roof really was spared. So the internal ceiling was affected, but not the roof. What we're looking at in terms of roof repair this year is really just an aging covering. And so we want to make sure that it remains watertight when we finish the interior restoration, so that we're not putting, you know, that restoration at risk.
So let's talk about the interior restoration in terms of the goal for 2026. What is the goal this year?
Well, the goal this year, the ultimate goal, of course, is to reopen the church. So we received some very significant capital funding from the Ontario Trillium Foundation. So this is a grant for $154,000 that we'll see us complete the interior restoration of the church to the point that we can regain an occupancy permit. So we're not talking, you know, every last flourishing detail or everything on our wish list, but we are talking about the basics that are necessary to get that occupancy permit and to welcome the community back. So that really would encompass things like fire separation between the floors, the replacement of that ceiling that I mentioned that was damaged in the fire. So, you know, we're looking at removing the charred lumber, rebuilding the ceiling, new vapor barriers, obviously drywall and plaster wall repairs on the inside. There's going to be repairs to the floor at the entry where the fire occurred. And then, you know, some details as well, like restoring the crown molding, the wainscoting, that sort of stuff as well. So it's a fairly extensive project.
So it kind of paints us a picture of what the aesthetics will look like. I mean, when someone walks into the church, when it finally does open, what are they going to expect to see?
So, you know, our ultimate goal is to put it back. Put it back the way it was. So when they come in, we're hoping that they see the same calm, beautiful blue color throughout. We're hoping that pretty much when they walk in, what they're seeing is the history of Wesleyville Village. This really was sort of the cornerstone of the community. And so we want to put back that feel. We want to return it to the community hub that it once was. So, and really when I say that, what I mean is we're not trying to reimagine this space. We are trying to restore the space.
Wonderful. And do you have an anticipated date of when you want to reopen the church?
So, I mean, that's going to be a moving target, of course. However, the goal, goal here is that we are looking at a 12-month project timeline starting from December 2025. So really we're aiming to have the church reopened, hopefully, by December 2026. We're in the final stretch. So, you know, when I tell people this is the moment, I think this really is the moment. We've come so far from 2021 in terms of, you know, we've added accessibility to the church. We've, you know, been constantly working behind the scenes, and now we're down to the final stage of the project. And so I think within a year, we should expect to, you know, apply for that occupancy permit and hopefully get people back into the space.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, January 8th, daytime high of 3 degrees, actually feeling a touch warmer at 4. Cloudy conditions, but no snow, rain, or sleet in the forecast. Dry day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, January 9th, daytime high of 4 degrees, feeling closer to 0, so just hovering around freezing, with some periods of rain in the morning. Otherwise, it'll be gray and cloudy. Saturday, January 10th, daytime high of 4 degrees, feeling closer to 0, so very little temperature movement from Friday into Saturday. 55% chance of rain in the afternoon, otherwise cloudy. Sunday, January 11th, daytime high of 2 degrees, but it's actually going to feel closer to minus 6, possibility of a little bit of snow in the afternoon. And then Monday, January 12th, daytime high of minus 1, but feeling closer to minus 10, quite chilly here in the city of Kingston.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering. Today's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from Harmony Music Lounge's Origin Story Volume 2, a full-length album written, performed, and produced entirely by youth from Napanee and Kingston. From it, we'll listen to Gasoline by Brielle Banderson and Atlas Rossborough, a slow-burning alt-rock single that explores emotional overload, performed with grit and grace by two standout members of the youth band Sound Chamber, who were both in grade 9 at the time of recording. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Origin Story Volume 2 on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Gasoline here with us on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Where stories meet sound. My name is Simmer Kaur, host of Melodies of Myth, a show that blends Indian classical and Western music with short tales of culture, history, and identity. Join me every Friday at 3 p.m. only on CFRC. And if you enjoy the music, you can find more by searching Simmer Kaur on Spotify. Tune in, unwind, and let the melodies carry you. Once again, it's Melodies of Myth, 3 p.m. every Friday.
Ah,
Saturday mornings. Whether you're waking up in a stranger's apartment or enjoying some time with the family, you need a nutritional breakfast for your ears. So join me, DJ Over Easy, for Makin' Bacon every Saturday morning from 8 until 10 on CFRC 101.9 and CFRC.ca.
What do you listen to make your Monday mornings that much better? Absolutely Frivolous on CFRC 101.9 FM. We play all kinds of comedy, stand-up, sketch, songs, even poetry, and the occasional interview. Mondays at 10:30 a.m. Tune in or listen to Absolutely Frivolous on our archives page on CFRC.ca.
St. Monday watches over you and me and grants the bone exhausted some liberty.
Hello and welcome back to another year of Plugged in My Ears podcast. Happy New Year. This is the first episode of 2026. It's Adam, Kyle, and Sam here to talk about all of the biggest happenings in the world of sports. We've got some interesting topics today, as always. We're going to start with talking about the Quinn Hughes trade and a very famous retirement. Sam, do you have any thoughts on this major retirement that we're going to discuss?
I do, but just quickly, I should preface for the listener, in case you hear an extra voice, Adam's lovely girlfriend, Tara, also a former high-performing athlete, here today. She may or may not speak, and that's totally okay, although hopefully she does jump in here and there. But yes, I will say it is with great sorrow and regret that we have to accept the fact that John Cena is no longer going to compete in the realm of the WWE. I think a lot of people often argue that he isn't the greatest WWE fighter of all time, or that he is. But that misses the point. People should really be grateful and appreciate the fact that we got to live through his legacy. John Cena changed the WWE in many respects. I think the first person to change the WWE and make it super, super popular was probably Dwayne Johnson. He was the first mega WWE superstar. And then, of course, came Brock Lesnar, who started in the WWE, transitioned to the UFC, and beat everyone up. So we went back to the WWE. But what John Cena was able to do was perhaps second to none. I've never seen someone mobilize so many people in so many good ways. And I will say that a lot of athletes in the WWE do some things that are perhaps questionable. Not that they're bad, but they're not always good moral leaders, and they don't always set the best examples. And I challenge any person to find a mistake of moral competence that John Cena has ever made in his career. And if he's remembered for anything, it probably will be that, if he's not remembered as being the best WWE fighter of all time. So yeah, I'm really sad that John Cena is gone.
Yeah, a true legend of the sport.
I don't think he's replaceable. Yeah, he is. I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I think it's a big deal, because I feel like John Cena was one of the major icons for me growing up. I didn't pay attention too much to the WWE, but as whenever I think of WWE, I think of John Cena. So it's crazy to see the end of one career, but I do think that this means he'll get into more acting gigs, because he seems to be a pretty prolific actor now. I feel like some of his most recent movies have maybe been kind of one-sided, but I know he did all that Marvel stuff, or DC, I think it was. He's acting as one of the superheroes. I don't know for sure the name of it, but I've seen like clips on TikTok.
Peacemaker, I think it's called.
Peacemaker, yeah. So I think he's going to be just as successful with acting, just because I think it is all about the attitude that he brought to the sport. And he just seems to be a guy with a really good head on his shoulders and a true legend of the fighting world. But yeah, no, great career. Congratulations, Kyle. Any thoughts on John Cena?
No, they're going to have a hard time finding another wrestler to replace him that speaks Chinese, or say Mandarin.
Yes.
But yeah. Maybe they will eventually.
Yes, he will be probably the best Mandarin-speaking WWE wrestler of all time. Okay, moving on to a real sport, the NHL. Quinn Hughes got traded. I know it's been a while since we have talked on the show with a new episode, but yes, we've not made an episode since the Quinn Hughes deal. We have to talk about it before we get into anything else, because this is a major trade that shook up the NHL, and you don't see trades like this that happen too often. I feel like this is like definitely a rare moment when a top 10 player in the NHL gets traded like this. I mean,
the last time was from Ottawa when Eric Karlsson got traded for a bag of pucks.
That's a good comparison.
Tim Stützle.
Well, we didn't have Tim Stützle at the time. I mean, granted, yeah, Vancouver might get something great out of this trade too. But at the time when Ottawa made the trade, we traded Karlsson with something like 700 points for a combined total of 110 points in return.
Yeah.
In terms of players. So, and this is the same thing for Vancouver. They're giving up what I would argue is their most consistent offensive producer for great uncertainty. And so it was a high risk. It could be high reward, but it could also be high failure.
I don't know. I look at this trade package that they got back, and it is a very good trade package. They got Marco Rossi, Liam Ogren, Ziv Boyum, and a 2026 first round pick. Those are three solid, like, they're already developed prospects, like guys that have played games in the NHL, and a first round pick for Quinn Hughes. Obviously, Quinn Hughes is such a unique player that I do think you can't really, you can't get what Quinn Hughes gave you from either of these, any of these players or this pick. But this is a pretty good consolation prize if you're Vancouver, I think. Especially Boyum, I'm really big on him. I think he's a very underrated rookie right now, and he's played really well for Vancouver since coming over. Kyle, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a funny way, like long term, this trade is terrible for Minnesota. I mean, they did basically sell the farm on this one. They sold all of their top young prospects, which are more valuable than a pick, by the way, because you know that they're going to pan out to be something decent, whereas I'd say the pick is actually less valuable, but still another big piece to that trade. So it's huge. I mean, obviously Quinn Hughes isn't really replaceable, but that being said, since we're talking about this later after the fact, we know more about what happened. And essentially Quinn Hughes forced a trade. So, I mean, in the scenario where Vancouver had to get rid of him, I feel like they got a pretty good deal out of it, really. But yeah, I'm not too bummed about it. But Vancouver's in a rebuild for the next 5 years now.
Yeah, no,
there's no way out of that.
Since the trade, they've tanked to the bottom of the standings. Them and Winnipeg are down there in the last two or three spots. And it does look like they're in full rebuild mode now. I wouldn't be surprised if Pettersson's moved at the trade deadline now, because this team is, again, like Kyle said, in the middle of a rebuild. Sam, your words?
Oh, yeah, I agree with that, too. But I also think from what Minnesota's perspective, this isn't going to work. Like, I'll be the first to say it, Quinnesota is never going to be a thing, right? Let's be realistic, Quinn Hughes is probably going to try and leave Minnesota too. No one thought he wanted to go to Minnesota. I think it's fair to assume that he wanted to go to New Jersey to play with his brothers. That probably would have made New Jersey a top five team in the league automatically, because he's that dominant on the ice. So forever along Quinn Hughes is condemned to Minnesota, he will stay. But he's gone. So this isn't even a good trade for Minnesota either. Let's be frank. And I do think that it's fair to say that they're in a rebuild now, so it still is a bad trade for Vancouver. Like, this is just a win-lose. This is a lose-lose situation for both teams. Objectively, what happened was terrible. What should have happened is that Vancouver should have traded Quinn Hughes to some other team for just a crap ton of draft picks. Or Minnesota should have gave them a crap ton of draft picks instead of giving players who are already developing. Because even if those players end up being okay and they go to Vancouver, they're not going to make a difference. Had they stayed in Minnesota with Quinn Hughes, they would have made a difference. And then the future prospects, whatever. Who knows? Maybe we draft someone who's good. Maybe we don't. If we draft anyone from this year from Canada, or if anyone who's on this World Juniors team from Canada and you end up plays on Vancouver, they're going to be terrible, right? Like, we just know that. But I just think this was objectively a bad trade. I'm not a hockey expert. Obviously, if I was, I would be there doing the trade myself. But I think that any person who looks at this over the long term can agree that this is just not going to pan out for either team in a good way.
I think there's uncertainty. I would err on the side of It's a gamble for Minnesota. Like, if they go and have a great playoff run this year, which I'm of the belief that they probably still won't, like, they might go second round, I would say. But I can't see them going to the Cup Finals still. I mean, they got a great team, but, you know, some of the other teams in the league are looking pretty scary, especially in that division, right? Like Dallas and the Avalanche, like, you know, it's a tough division. So, yeah, it's a bit of a gamble. Maybe it pays off. I have a feeling it won't. And then, yeah, like you said, Minnesota's going to lose Quinn Hughes after about a year and a half. So,
yeah,
then they're back where they started.
I do think that their tough division is part of why they put forth a trade package for Quinn Hughes, though, because Minnesota's in an interesting spot where they're going to play Dallas in the playoffs. Like, I don't think you're... Colorado, I can't see falling off into that second place in the division. Like, they're going to play Dallas, and Dallas is a great team, and you need to have as good of a team if you're even going to get a chance to beat Dallas in the first round. So I see what they're thinking here, because they don't really want to make this a waste of a year, because realistically, Minnesota's not beating Dallas with Marco Rossi, Zeev Boyum, and Liam Ogren. Like, that's just not happening. But now that you have Quinn Hughes, I think you got a better chance. So I do think that it was a strategic play by Minnesota for this year. In the long term, I think this benefits Vancouver more, because these pieces, like, could turn into things that they trade away. They could turn into things that they decide to keep. A lot more flexibility there, as you, Kyle and Sam mentioned, with Quinn Hughes not staying around in Minnesota very long. It is definitely an eye-opening trade for Minnesota. Personally, I'm more of a big fan of this for Vancouver, but definitely an interesting trade that we don't see too many of in today's NHL. But yeah, any final thoughts before we move on to the World Juniors about this deal?
Well, I'll say one other thing. Speaking of the Hughes and the New Jersey Devils, I don't know if you guys saw, Luke Hughes scored 2 own goals in 1 game.
I didn't see that.
I've never seen anything like that before in my life. And especially the second one, I've never seen anything like that. He literally just lost the handle on the puck and put it right in there. I mean, yeah, that was kind of unbelievable.
Oh, man.
And then the camera pan over to Jake Allen after, that just looks like completely confused.
Habs
the
legend.
Fans started booing him in the crowd for the rest of the game when he was touching the puck.
Oh, man.
Yeah, pretty rough.
Yeah, New Jersey's a team in an interesting situation, too, because, I mean, with Jack getting injured, they kind of tanked out of the playoffs right now. But they're a team that I can see making a bit of a comeback and climbing back up, because they're right now 6th in the Metro, which is the weakest division in the NHL. I still see, I don't think their season's done, but definitely 2 own goals does not help their case. Okay, moving on to some international hockey, the World Junior Tournament, a holiday favorite. I feel like I spend all my holiday seasons anticipating the World Juniors and watching the World Juniors, and it hasn't been easy for us Canadians the last few years. This is a third year without a gold medal. Canada did finish with bronze, with Czechia taking silver and Sweden being the champions. I will say one positive part of this tournament is the U.S. did not medal and didn't even make it to the semifinals. So as much as that is a hater mentality, I will say that I was happy to see the States not advance. This was an interesting team, because I feel like we got very different vibes from last year, where they tried to make a locker room friendly team last year and didn't take the most skilled players. And this year they definitely took the most skilled players. And it almost just seems like none of these skilled players knew how to play defense. It almost felt like a team of 21 forwards and 2 goalies. I thought they played well. I thought Canada played well against Czechia. I just think Czechia beat them at their own game and played better. The goaltending was fine in this tournament. You can say what you want about Carter George in that first Czechia game, but I thought Ivan Kovic played well. I thought the offense was buzzing. I mean, McKenna had like the third best World Juniors performance ever for a Canadian statistically. I mean, it's just kind of the defense was just not there. I mean, I think Zane Parekh is a great defenseman at scoring goals, but not great at playing defense. Did I kind of hit this one on the head, or do you guys have differing opinions on this tournament?
Yeah, Parekh reminds me of a kind of a Bouchard 2.0. Like I said earlier, he's same guy. Great offense, but the defensive side is definitely lacking. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing that stood out to me the most, which I mean I'm still a little confused by, frankly, is that Czechia was just straight up faster. I don't know if that's an effort thing or like they just physically are faster players. I kind of doubt that. But they just skated harder the entire game.
Mm-hmm.
So like you're not going to win. It's almost impossible to win a game where the entire team on the other side is outskating you every single shift and every single puck battle. And you're getting beat every single time you go on the ice. Like, you can't win a game like that. They were just getting absolutely mauled in the neutral zone every single shift. And most of their goals came from power plays.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can't win a game like that ever.
No, I agree. Sam?
I agree too. And I mean, I won't poke the dead dog with a stick. You guys have said pretty much everything I was thinking. But I will say this. The entirety of Canada's gameplay could be characterized as a series of selfish plays, undisciplined penalties, unsportsmanlike behavior, and misconduct. I mean, this year, maybe not off the ice, but definitely on the ice. Mm-hmm. And they kind of got excused or explained away after the game immediately by Hockey Canada's general manager. So I didn't really like that. But we definitely protect egos instead of teaching responsibility, from what I can see. And the one thing I will say is that it is very evident to me that the rest of the world has learned a lot from the way Team Canada plays. They study how we play and they mimic it too. And then they build structured programs around it. And I'm not a big fan of the US NDTP. I genuinely believe that the Canadian Hockey League, so the OHL, the QMJHL, and the WHL are the ways to go. Mm-hmm. But we have to face reality that other countries are beating us because their players train together for years. The US NDTP starts when kids are 14. Every single kid on that US team has been together since they were 14 years old, of playing every single day of the week together until they started going off to their own colleges. And so they take 1 year apart and they come back together and they're basically fine. Sweden does it too now. So does Finland. And Canada's very lucky in that we somehow produce absurd amounts of talent. And I think it's not because we do anything better. I think it's literally just because more kids are interested in playing hockey in Canada. But as the game continues to expand, we're going to come to a point where we're actually like New Zealand is in rugby, where they're not the best anymore. They once were the crown herald of the sport, and now it's South Africa's sport. 1 year it's England's the next, it's Ireland's the next after that. Hockey's going to become that really soon, too. Every single country is catching up to Canada in terms of medals. Every single one of them that's good. So Sweden, U.S., Finland. And imagine if Russia was there. How bad would we have done if Russia played? How bad would we have done if Demidov got released from the Habs? Granted, I don't think he would have gotten released from the Habs. But seriously, how bad would we have done? We would not have done well. Yeah. And we can make the excuse that, oh, you Celebrini and Schaefer in the NHL. Okay, and every single player but McKenna and Bertenhoff or whatever his name is weren't first-round draft picks. And McKenna's projected to go first overall, and so is the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
There's no excuse. We allow kids who are really good at hockey to get away with selfish hockey. And to me, it feels like they always play for the last name on the back of their jersey, but never for the crest on the front. And that is the problem. Canada valorizes high level players, high skilled players, but we don't care about people who will block shots or who will be stay at home defensemen and clear the front of the net. Because A, it doesn't sell tickets in the NHL, and B, we've somehow decided that the best offense is in defense. Now the best offense is simply offense, and we just have to pray that the defense isn't bad enough. Hockey didn't used to be that way. I agree there's something to be said for there being more goals in a game. In the early 2000s when the NHL averaged a goal a game, yeah, hockey was perhaps less interesting. But I will say this, Crosby's not scoring any less points now than he was then, so obviously he was doing something right, and he's defense first.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think we have to go back to those days where we actually cared about the front of our net and the front of our crest, not the back.
So is this a selection thing? Do you think that this is more on Hockey Canada to select more defensive-minded players, or do you think it's more of a development thing in general?
This is a development thing. Like, you know, I'll give you an example. I'm not like I'm a good hockey coach or anything, but when I think about coaching hockey, the one thing I think about is skill development. And when you think about skill development, there's two facets to it. There's the offensive facet and the defensive facet. I was a defenseman. And I'm way more defensively skilled than I am offensively skilled. So much so that, I mean, like, truthfully, I'm not going to act like I'm an insane hockey player, but defensively, I was as good as anyone else in the OHL. Granted, I was a lot worse offensively than almost every single player. and that's why I didn't really stick around for more than 2 minutes of ice time. But needless to say, a good hockey player is a defensive hockey player, and we just don't care about that anymore. Yeah. Like, I promise you, there are 100 defensemen in the OHL who are better defensively than Zane Parikh, but they don't put up 50 points a year, and therefore they didn't make the team. And Zane Parikh went first of all. Like, yeah, he's helping you win games, but he's definitely helping you lose games too.
Yeah. No, I agree. I thought the coaching was great this year. I will say Dale Hunter, I think, did a good job coaching this team. I do think that part of the reason they were losing so many neutral zone battles against Czechia is because they were constantly playing from behind. They had a lead early in the first, but after that lead disappeared, they were playing from behind. And it even seemed when they tied it up, like when Martone scored that goal, I'm like, just park the bus and take it to overtime. Like, what's going on here? Why are we giving Czechia two odd man rush chances at the end of the game with a minute to go, which obviously they score on one of them? That seemed like poor game management. I don't know how much of that is on the coaching, but I don't know if Canada thought that they could score another before the end of the period and not even take it to overtime, but I thought that that was kind of egotistical play. And I want to talk about another thing that that I think it was either you, Kyle, or Sam mentioned about the sportsmanship. Like, Canada, this team seemed to be one of the most, like, poor character teams I've seen in a while. Like, Martone slapping that guy on the butt after the end of the first game. I'm like, like, sure, that's funny, but, like, what are we doing here? Like, act like a professional. Like, I know you're not a professional. You're a junior hockey player, but you're about to be a professional. And that doesn't really have a place for me. And, like, it does kind of come back around to bite them in the butt because they lost to the Czechs in the semis to the exact same team that he did that action to. And I just think that that's pathetic from your captain. So, Sam, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, too many to list, but I mean, I agree with everything you're saying. I will just say this. Porter Martone will never play in the NHL. Never.
Okay, he's going to play in the NHL.
After this tournament, he will never play in the NHL. He looked like an undrafted Danish player the whole time, and he acted like one too. I'm serious. If I was a GM right now, I'd say, holy crap, I wasted a pick on this ignoramus.
Yeah, there's some things revealing that tournament. I can't
think of a more appropriate word that's polite to say than ignoramus. He is an ignoramus.
That's fair enough. I think he's still going to play, but, like, yeah, Kyle, go ahead.
I want to tie it into the Olympic roster because, you know, I think what's happening in the juniors is reflective of what has kind of come out of, you know, Hockey Canada production in general. Like, if you look at our team compared to all the other teams and their Olympic rosters, the only department where Canada is the best, it's not even close, is our forwards.
Mm-hmm.
But the defense, you can definitely make a case that we're not. I mean, the Americans have got great defense. So do the Swedes. The Finnish got some pretty good defense too. And goaltending too, right? So I would say it's pretty accurate that, you know, we've kind of become mostly forward focused really in development.
Yeah. No. And I do think that is a red flag. I do think the defense needs to be more of a focus. But I do want to talk about the Olympic team because I do think they made some choices. They made some decisions that would definitely support more what we're saying about this defensive minded hockey, especially when it comes to the defense. One notable name not on the roster was Evan Bouchard, who is one of the better offensive defensemen in the NHL. Say what you want about his defense, but he's a great offensive defenseman, and he wasn't added to the roster, but the likes of Thomas Harley were. Colton Parayko were. Both players that are great defensively, but I would say are not as good offensively as Evan Bouchard. So I was surprised to see Bouchard not added to the roster. One player that I was surprised to see on the roster was Drew Doughty. I don't think Drew Doughty brings very much to Team Canada. I think he's slow. I think he should retire. I think that he is more of a liability than anything on this roster. And I just because of the players that were taken, that were not taken over Doughty. That's the only reason I'm thinking this is because I do think players like Bouchard, Noah Dobson could have been added to Team Canada just based on the way that they've played this year. Any thoughts on the defense before we move on to the forwards and goaltending?
I think the one thing I will say is that in the Four Nations, we didn't have Makar. So that was a big factor. So the fact that if he's actually going to be sticking around, that's huge. Mm-hmm. I think the only person that I feel like kind of got snubbed and maybe could have been in there was Schaefer.
Yeah,
he's been playing unbelievable. But that being said, he's super young and is a defenseman that's like relatively untested. I kind of understand why he didn't make it. Mm-hmm. But if he made it over Drew Doughty, I would have not been that surprised.
I would have been fine with that. Yeah, I do think Drew Doughty is kind of a sore thumb out there. I don't know. It just seems like wrong to have him on this team for some reason.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, Sam, I know you love your veterans.
I mean, I do, but I don't disagree with what you guys are saying. Drew Doughty is undoubtedly a good hockey player, but I'm kind of in disbelief that he made the roster.
Yeah,
I didn't think he was going to make it at all. He's good. Actually, to be fair, in the Four Nations Cup, he was pretty good. He was pretty good. And just to say one thing too, we actually did have McCarr for the gold medal game.
Oh, Four Nations. Okay.
And the Americans didn't have Charlie McAvoy.
Wow.
Whereas now we will have both of our best defensemen. But I agree. Like after Morrissey, who do we have on defense? Literally nobody. The reason why Doughty was good in the Four Nations Cup though is because he made simple plays. And sometimes older guys, by virtue of the fact that they can't skate as fast anymore, just make the best simple play. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's what our defense needs to do because they're not good enough to do otherwise. The only guy who can skate the puck is McCarr. Morrissey's great on the blue line, but he can't skate the puck like McCarr can.
Yeah, I think Theodore's a pretty good addition to this team too. I really like Shea Theodore's game. I think he'll be able to do kind of power a second or third line, second and third defensive pairing. But Travis Sanheim was one guy that I did not think really earned his way onto this team. Again, like these are all great defensemen, but just when you look at the players like Schaefer and Bouchard that didn't get added to this team, it's hard to see the thinking picking these other guys over them, which we can talk a little bit about with the forwards too, because there are definitely some players here that probably weren't the best options available that definitely got on because of some political bias. I want to start with Braden Point and Anthony Cirelli, who I really think are only on this team because John Cooper is the head coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, because I don't want either of those players over Connor Bedard. And I don't think that's a crazy thing to say.
Well, I agree with you, actually. I think Bedard should have made it. I can't really say much because I don't agree with many of Hockey Canada's decisions, but I agree with you. But Dart should have made the roster. It's a joke that he didn't. Maybe they felt they couldn't have two young guys on the team, mm-hmm. but from past experience, young guys tend to score golden goals in the Olympic gold medal game. So there's something to be said about having a couple 20-year-olds on the ice. But you're right. Cirelli shouldn't have even been in the discussion for the actual roster. In my view, he was probably a tier three forward, not a tier two.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah. I do like, other than that, like the forwards, of course, solid. Go ahead, Kyle.
Oh, yeah. I think, well, the thing that happened with Braden Point was that he was one of the people that was, like, pre-selected.
Oh,
so yeah. They couldn't really get out of that. He was, like, selected right away because he's been such a good player for so long. He's had a weird start to this season, but in his last five games, he's been pretty hot.
Okay. All right.
So I'm not too worried about him. I think he'll be good.
Yeah.
I still think Hagel is one of the most underrated Canadian players like ever. Like this guy is, you know, he hasn't played a single season where his points per game hasn't gone up from the season previous.
That's impressive.
Every single season he's improved.
Yeah, there's a reason I didn't group him into that Cirelli Point Tampa Bay.
He
is a solid player. Yeah,
he had the most 5-on-5 goals and points last year.
That's
like not because he wasn't even on power play one. He had 90 points.
That's crazy that Chicago traded him.
Yeah, you know, he's a ridiculous player. I think there's a chance that Bedard does sneak back in if there's an injury.
Okay, yeah, I think he's
so there's an avenue for him to get back in. I think another one, though, is Wyatt Johnson.
He deserves
has been
to be there,
really
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
And he was also really good in the playoffs for Dallas last year. So I kind of would have liked to see him maybe on there, but...
Yeah. All right, so just before we wrap up, we're going to talk about the goaltending quickly. You just got under a minute. Kemper, Thompson, and Binnington, the three goalies. Any thoughts there? I know some people are saying that they would like to see a Blackwood or a Wedgwood in there, but over Kemper, I think, is the thought. But I do think Binnington is going to take the majority of the starts. But any thoughts on that before we wrap up?
Yeah,
the lumber yard in Avalanche has been very productive. So the two woods would have been good to see. I think Logan Thompson has been performing well enough that Hockey Canada was kind of forced to put aside whatever previous issues they had with him, which is still unknown.
Yeah.
But they kind of just got forced there. Mark Scheifele, I'll say that. He did something behind the scenes, and now he's been blacklisted from Hockey Canada. I don't know what he did, though.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was interesting to see his name not on there either. Sam, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just saying, Montembeau should have been the third goaltender.
Oh, okay, that's enough.
Not because he's good, but just because he's a microphone. I think in these pivotal hours, we need to remind our brothers in Quebec and sisters in Quebec that we still value them. We didn't really